Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
On April 19, 1995, a little before 9 a.m, ex-soldier Timothy McVeigh parked a Ryder rental truck outside the Alfred P. Murray Federal Building in Oklahoma City. Inside the truck was a crude yet lethal bomb made from fertilizer, diesel, petrol. McVeigh locked the truck and walked away. Moments later, at 9:02, the truck exploded, tearing the front of the building apart, killing 168 people, including 19 children, and injuring hundreds more.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is Monsters Who Murder, Serial Killer Confessions.
Police found 27 corpses.
Australia's worst serial killer.
You know, I didn't want to get in the car. I actually...
With Amanda Howlett and Robert McKnight.
Hello there, I'm Rob McKnight. Welcome to Monsters Who Murder, Serial Killer Confessions. And as always, we have the serial killer whisperer, true crime author and criminologist Amanda Howard with us. Hello, Amanda.
Hello, Robert. Here we go again with a really interesting case, and I'm glad that we're finally getting into some terrorism.
Well, it's a well-known one, so I'm looking forward to getting your insights into Timothy McVeigh.
Yeah, and this was one that I had high hopes for, and you'll see how that goes as we move through it. I was hoping I had a smart guy, and we'll see what Ted Kaczynski has to say about him.
Okay, let's get into it, because it was a beautiful day in Oklahoma City. At least it started out as a beautiful day. The sun was shining, flowers were blooming. It was springtime in Oklahoma City. So said the prosecutor in his opening statement in the case against the Oklahoma bomber. On 19 April 1995, Timothy McVeigh, a 27-year-old ex-soldier, had parked a rented truck in front of the Alfred P. Murray Federal Building in Oklahoma City. He got out of the driver's seat, closed the door behind him, and casually headed toward the getaway vehicle, driven by friend and co-conspirator Terry Nichols. McVeigh placed tiny protective plugs into his ears and ignited two timing devices as they drove away. Just above the explosive-packed rental truck was a childcare centre, where children of employees of the building spent their days playing. Moments after the explosives were detonated, 168 people, including 19 children, were killed, as upper floors concertinaed down onto the floors below. Hundreds more were injured, while 300 surrounding buildings were damaged in the blast. And until September 11, 2001, it was the worst terrorist attack ever carried out on US soil. After the bombing, McVeigh avoided detection for only a brief time and was arrested no more than 75 minutes after the fact by Trooper Charles Hanger. The car in which McVeigh and Nichols were travelling, a 1977 Mercury Marquis, had lost its rear license plate. And after they were pulled over, the two men were found to be carrying loaded concealed weapons. Once in custody, McVeigh and Nichols were soon charged with the bombings. Here is CNN's footage of the bombing as recorded by cameras across the street from the Murray Building.
At 8:57 a.m., security cameras at the Regency Tower apartment building, a few blocks west of the Murrah Building, catch the Ryder truck parked across the street. Investigators surmise this is when McVeigh lights the first fuse. A few minutes later, McVeigh moves the truck up, lights the second fuse, and parks on the north side of the Murrah Building. He then exits the truck and begins walking rapidly to the yellow Mercury parked four blocks away. At the Federal Building, the workday is starting. Hundreds of people are already inside.
Now, Amanda, It's interesting, isn't it? Because while he was in prison, McVeigh agreed to do a 60 Minutes interview. And, of course, we have to note that this is VHS quality. So someone has recorded it on VHS when it aired. They have uploaded it to YouTube. So there's a bit of distortion throughout the recording. The rule of the interview were that the journalist could not ask about his guilt, particularly because McVeigh was also going through the appeals process. Isn't that right, Amanda?
Yes, and so it sort of makes it very difficult for them to sort of play this game where they're just going to sort of say, oh, I'm going to ask you just slowly into there and then we're going to go somewhere else. It's just sort of they tried to tease it out of him, hoping it would work. But with his lawyer sitting there, that wasn't going to happen too much.
Okay. Well, his first answer will give you a fair indication of his self-importance.
Maybe one of the benefits of me talking to you today is that you'll see that maybe not everything is true that you've heard about me.
Okay, Amanda, we're off. Let's do the double speak a la Manson, hey?
I know. I get images of Bill Clinton as well. I think it's his kind of accent because I'm an Aussie. They all sound the same to me anyway. But there's a bit of
I
a Clinton,
did not put
you know,
bombs in that rental truck.
Oh, too soon.
Sorry.
But it's just interesting that, you know, he's like, oh, well, maybe this might happen and maybe that might happen. And so he's just sort of starting from a place of manipulation and that basically he's the most important person in the room. And we've seen this before when we did Ed Kemper doing a journalist interview as well. He did the same thing. They realize that they're there to see them. They're rock stars. And so they yes. want to play that game of, you know, I did this because it was for the greater good. You know, I did this because, you know, I didn't like my mum and all of this sort of stuff. So he is starting from a place of like, I know how great I am.
Do you reckon he's got a bit of resting bitch face?
Oh my God, yes. And it's as someone with resting bitch face, and so people think I'm always cranky, I totally get it. But
you
there's just
cranky.
Moments. Oh, shut up. but yeah. But what we're seeing here is that there is micro expression. So those that are watching the film, they'll be able to see that he does a couple of snarls a few times, especially in this beginning, that he thinks he's hiding well by sort of trying to have a blank expression. But that curled Elvis lip comes through and you know that it's just absolute contempt for what's going on and he just needs to get his story and walk out of jail a free man.
All right, well, let's take a closer look at that. And if you want to see it, just go to patreon.com/MWMconfessions or mwm.uscreen.io and you can get onto the video tiers. But let's have a look at this snarl you're talking about.
One of the benefits of me talking to you today is that...
there it is. So we've slowed down the vision, as you could hear on the audio podcast, but he does have a bit, dare I say, a bit of the Elvis snarl going on there.
It is. And it's because that's how he's feeling. You know, he wants this to be a friendly chat, like, you know, guys, you have to understand my side of the story because in court, you know, he didn't get to tell his side of the story and all of this sort of stuff that's going on. And he's just trying to sort of start off, but he's like, yeah, I know where you want to go with this and so I have contempt for you.
Yeah, apparently McVeigh's favourite song to listen to in jail was Jailhouse Rock by the King himself. I don't know. Is that true? Maybe not.
That's the best joke ever. Next time I'm going to get you with the Elvis impression as well. So that's got me.
All right. Let's get serious now because the journalist Ed Bradley asks for some examples.
What's not true?
Well, am I pure evil? Am I the face of terror sitting here in front of you? Or am I able to talk to you man to man?
Isn't that an interesting psychology? You can't talk man to man and be evil too. He seems to be implying the two, or not implying, pretty much saying that the two are mutually exclusive.
Yeah, and, you know, he seems to have that misconception, you know, and, you know, it comes down to that thing that we discuss often in this, that, you know, you have to look evil to be evil. Resting bitch face doesn't make you evil, but he's just trying to say that, you know, I'm just a man, you know, standing in front of you, wanting you to love me, or whatever that quote is, you know. But he wants
now
us
you're
to.
You're quoting Notting Hill, Jesus.
Notting Hill. I'm a huge Hugh Grant fan. I can't help that. Don't hold it against me, though. You know, but he wants to hold a conversation that is away from the crime. He wants to talk about the person who Timothy McVeigh is. He doesn't want to talk about the bomber, the terrorist attack, his time in the army. He wants to talk about that he is, you know, agent of God who's come to do something wonderful. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And this had to happen for a certain reason.
Mm. Well, anyone inside the US who's watched 60 Minutes knows Ed Bradley is a very good journalist. In Australia, we have 60 Minutes, so he's of that ilk of a high-quality current affairs program. And, of course, a journalist like him isn't going to let McVeigh off the hook.
Most people in this country think you are the face of evil, don't they?
They do. But sitting down here now, and let me make clear, I'm not sitting here trying to influence you, and I'm not putting on a game face. I'm not conning anybody. I'm just being me. And maybe people will listen, as opposed to not listening at a trial.
Couple of things there. My bullshit detector is going off. Even dickhead Derek knows that everybody who does an interview is trying to get something across. Otherwise, you don't do interviews. So he is definitely trying to change the public perception of himself. Why does he feel that at a trial people won't listen? That just seems like a false narrative when every bit of evidence is under scrutiny at a trial.
Yeah, and they are actually innocent until proven guilty as well. But this was a trial that was huge at the time. You know, like I sort of followed it here from Australia. You know, it was just one of those cases that's like, how does this happen? You know, now these days we see it so much more. And you know, 2001 come, and all of that sort of stuff that changed our perception of safety and terrorism. But he's like, hey, look at me. You don't understand me. I'm here to explain. You know, that I'm here to do good. I'm a normal person. It wasn't that I'm an evil person who chose to do this. I'm a normal person who felt that he was compelled to do this because it was to bring light to other atrocities that were going on. You don't need to kill, you know, 160 people to get that point across, you know. But his snarls are still there. He's getting these tense lips that are really tight when he stops. There's moments that you can tell that he's holding things in. His emotions are right there and he's angry. You can tell that he's angry, and he knows that he's there to fight to get off the death penalty. It's amazing how these people fight for their own lives when they didn't care about the, you know, 1,000 people that were in that building. And yeah, that's the part that I don't think they understand. You know,
it's just weird. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Interestingly, the journalist asked McVeigh what he felt about seeing the bombing in the news.
Everyone in America saw the pictures on television, heard the news on the radio. What was your reaction when you saw those pictures?
I think, like everyone else, I thought it was a tragic event. And that's all I really want to say.
Amanda, you always make me count when there is a silence like that. That's about 9 seconds. He was not ready for that question, was he?
No, and that's the first time that we're actually seeing him focus on the actual event and see what he saw as a normal person with everyone else in society seeing those news programs. And he called it a tragic event, not a terrorist attack, not, you know, something I was compelled to do, not something that, oh my God, someone else might have done. You know, obviously his lawyer is telling him there that if you don't want to say anything, say, and that's all I have to say, because he's going to say that a few times, I think, in this, that will show that he has been prepped and he has been trained on how to act to these. But, you know, he could have denied it then and there. He could have said, I didn't do this. And smartly, he didn't say it. But, you know, that was the opportunity right there to say, you know, I was as shocked as everyone else, but he didn't.
Yeah, it was really interesting how he took, I just took a moment then to think about what I was trying to say. But going through his head right then was, what can I say? What is the least amount of damage to answer that question? And he didn't actually answer the question. He didn't say
no.
Any of the things that you said. He didn't say what his reaction was to it. It was complete avoidance while trying to minimize his involvement. It's very, very interesting. And being a good journalist, the 60 Minutes journo pushes a little bit more and we get another long pause.
And the children?
I thought it was terrible that there were children in the building.
So the question was, and the children? Long pause. Yes, it was terrible that there were children in the building. That is a statement, not anything else.
Yeah, there's no sympathy there. There's no softening. He's still harsh. He's still angry, basically, about what's going on. You know, he has no empathy for these children whatsoever. Though he's sort of saying, you know, I can't believe there was children in the building. He spent 9 months planning this event. We know so now that it took him a little over an hour. Yeah, he knew what was in that building. He would have gone in there 100 times or someone would have gone in there. They would have known that there was a child care center. If not else, he would have seen people going in with their children, you know, that parked outside. I know that there's probably parking underneath too. But the fact that, you know, he thought that he had this beautiful plan and he's now saying, you know, it's terrible that there was children in the building. It's not accepting blame. But there's no blame at all. It's to him, it's an oops.
Mm. Well, McVeigh is asked to address the victims and their families, and this is for the first time he appears animated, but only for a moment.
There are things that I want to say, but the timing is not right.
What do you mean?
At the time, right now, where I'm at in my appeals, where I'm at in my life, there are some issues that I just don't feel that it's the right time to discuss in depth.
Now, people of our age will know that those were tracking marks that you could see on the screen there when the VHS wasn't tracking properly. Younger people don't understand that concept at all because everything's digital, but we know. Amanda, it feels like he really does want to say something to the victims and their families.
Yeah, you'd think so, but I know what his final statement is when he gets executed. So that's going to sort of negate anything he feels that he wants to say now. And we will get to it. It's okay. You know, but I really doubt that he had anything of value to add. He wasn't going to say he was sorry because that then takes in blame. And he didn't want to do that. You know, he wanted to do what he did. He just didn't want to get caught. And that's what is the crux of so many of these cases. 9 months of planning took just over an hour to get caught. You know, no, he wasn't caught for the explosion. But, you know, pretty quickly they realise who he was. But it's just interesting that he's sort of like, oh, you know, I would want to say something. And he would do lip service of sorry and everything, but he's not sorry. He has no inkling of remorse for what he's done.
Yeah, well, you don't plan something like that and then be sorry about it. As you say, he knew what he was doing. McVeigh was then asked about the day he was first charged and being perp walked in front of the media and waiting throng.
What was that like for you that day? People were shouting at you. I remember somebody had shouted out, baby killer.
You go into a mode where you try to block external stimuli out. You're gearing up for anything to happen mentally, but at the same time, you're putting on your poker face because you're aware of how the media nitpicks at every little emotion that comes across on a face. You don't want to give them anything to feed off of.
Isn't it interesting looking at that footage? He doesn't appear to be the big brave guy who killed babies. Do you think he was afraid as he was being perp walked?
Absolutely. We have a guy here who is in a bright orange, beautiful Target jumpsuit that says, hey, this is the guy. And all of the cops and FBI and ATF around him are all wearing big jackets because they've got their Kevlar on. You know, they know that it could happen. And there's many times that we see this sort of thing where around them have on, you know, like the full neck ones and everything, because it's a chance it could happen. I don't know why it doesn't happen. No, I'm not going to get into the gun argument, but to me that was a perfect opportunity to fight for rights by someone else that was, you know, a member of family or something. To me, I wouldn't have been surprised if that happened. Thankfully, it doesn't happen, and these people do see justice. But it's just amazing that, as you said, you know, he's not this big guy, you know, screaming obscenities and saying, you know, I did the right thing and everything. He's just now a horrible person who killed babies, as you said.
Mm. And then going off on a tangent, Ed Bradley reads to McVeigh what he wrote in his high school yearbook.
In your high school yearbook, you, under future plans, you wrote, and I'm quoting here, okay, take it as it comes, buy a Lamborghini, California girls.
Right. Well, I'm dreaming. I'm putting down my dreams, you know. If I could rub a genie in a bottle, that's what I wish for, right? So...
It sounded like sheer desperation in that laugh, and even the way he looks off camera at the end, he's laughing, he's trying to be light, and then he has this moment where he looks down off camera and the face changes back to maybe a thought of what could have been.
Yeah, he made that decision. You know, sucks to be him, right? That, you know, he could have had the girls and the Lamborghini and everything, and he decided instead to kill people because he didn't like the government. You know, it's a very interesting way that he went. And I mean, we read high school yearbook things and things like that, and I know what I wrote in mine at the time too and everything. And we have these goals. And so sometimes I think we need to look back at those things. Like, that was his plan. Yeah, it was a funny teenage thing to say. But why would he go from there to there? Like, what happens in someone's life to go from, you know, California girls and singing David Lee Roth to murdering people in cold blood in a massive terrorist attack because you don't like what other people are doing?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah. Well, he's then asked about his military service and killing others in combat.
Well, I've broken that question down over the years and analyzed it every way, you know, trying to come to peace with it myself. In some ways, I can see the right and wrong of it. The right, I thought, well, it was self-defense. The reason I fired is because I saw muzzle flash, and I instinctively fired around in that direction. But then I thought, well, at the same time, I'm in this person's country. What right did I have to come over to his country and kill him? How did he ever transgress against me?
Okay, so he justifies killing in combat, but it wasn't about the ground level combat, but the machinations behind that.
Yeah, so he's sort of saying that, you know, it was self defense in war, you know, solo shot first kind of thing. You know, the enemy engaged, and so he shot back. It was self defense, you know. And then he says, you know, what right did I have to kill him in his own country? Well, yeah, what right did the children have to not be killed in their own country? You know, and it's just interesting how he can justify that killing and saying, yeah, you know, I didn't deserve to be there, and so I was in self-defense, and, you know, I shouldn't have done it, but I had to because he engaged first, to, you know, I've just killed 158 people, including 19 children. I mean, he doesn't see that it doesn't correlate. It doesn't go together. And it just shows how mixed up their thought processes are.
It's a complete contradiction when you, as you say, he's defending the people that they're going to their country and fighting, but then it's okay to kill innocent people in a building, children and adults. It's very, very weird.
It is. I mean, he saw combat, like, yes, as you just said, he was in the Gulf War. But at the same time, like, that's our enemy and he was fighting as part of a peacekeeping or whatever they decided to call it. But it's amazing, though, that coming back, you know, he went over there to fight for his government and now he comes back and fights against his government. It's just it's just mixed up.
Well, McVeigh is then asked about war and terrorism and why some killings are okay.
I went over there hyped up, just like everyone else. Not only is Saddam evil, all Iraqis are evil. What I experienced, though, was an entirely different ballgame. And being face-to-face, close with these people, in personal contact, you realize they're just people like you.
It's hard for some people to come to grips with you as the same person who was commended by the Army, who received the Bronze Star, who received the Combat Medal, as being the same person who was convicted in the Oklahoma City bombing. They can't put the two together. You understand that?
I do understand. They perceive, and many people have thrown this at me. They say, well, Tim, if we think you're guilty, imagine the paradox. In the Gulf War, you were given medals for killing people. So I've faced that that issue quite a few times with people that bring it up to me.
And how do you explain it, then?
At that point, usually I just leave it at that and say that it is an interesting paradox.
You could argue that what he's saying has a lot of merit. Now, obviously, I'm not condoning what he's done, but he was a hero in the war, but the bombing was also an act of war, and it's an interesting question, isn't it, about what acts of killing are okay? Very good question.
Yeah, it is, and we can think of it this way. If that bombing that he did, that was very successful in what he did, was done in Kuwait and, you know, or Afghanistan or anywhere like that where the US are at war, he would have gotten Purple Hearts and things like that for whatever they get for things like that. He would have been applauded and given a ticker tape parade when he come home for doing something so wonderful that, you know, hurt the government and the government agencies, because in that building in Oklahoma was government agencies. You know, so it's amazing that had he done it elsewhere, he would have been a hero. Doing it on home soil, he's now a traitor and it's a terrorist attack. But, yeah, you know, it's just amazing, especially in our climate now since September 11, that terrorism is like the worst of the worst, and that's what we seem to be focused on a lot. And we see fear and we see attacks across the world that are happening, you know, and these people are hated and reviled, but the people who support them see them as heroes. And so it's as he said, it's an interesting paradox. And I think it's something that it shows someone's thought process when it comes down to this. He was a hero in war. He brought the war home.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He thought he was doing a heroic thing. Yeah. It's just, yeah.
All right, so harking back to what you said about war and murder, McVeigh looks at his military career with disappointment after failing the physical to re-enlist.
Was that disappointing for you to not make it?
It was. But at the same time, I was losing motivation. This was during a period when I was coming to grips with my role in the Gulf War.
So is it fair to say that you were disillusioned when you came back? I mean, is that why you left the Army?
It's part of it. I'm sure something didn't feel right in me, but I couldn't quantify it. I couldn't say what it was.
So, did the war make him a killer and him serving, or was he actually getting to live out something that was within him? And is he blaming the war or the killing that he did on the field for making him restless and making him go down this path? What was his goal in trying to destroy this building?
Oh, that's a long question, and we will get to some of that later. But for this part about going to war to kill, or did it create someone that does kill? It's interesting in that one serial killer said to me one time, they send you to war and teach you to kill, but when you come back, they don't teach you not to kill. And it's a very interesting thing. And many serial killers that have seen combat have said this. Of course, the guy who said he'd seen combat was Arthur Shawcross, and he didn't, but he still claimed that he'd come home and was a killer purely because of the Vietnam War. But it's interesting that it does affect people. But we know of so many returned servicemen who don't go on to kill. But we know a lot of returned servicemen and women, obviously, as well, that are damaged by what they see. You know, they aren't there, you know, drinking cups of tea and enjoying themselves. They're, you know, every step could be their last. And they are in a place of constant stress and panic, which is why they prefer them not to go over again and again and again. And he didn't make it through the second time. It was because he wasn't fit, but I don't know if that was psychologically unfit, mentally, physical, all of that. I'm not quite sure why, and I'm sure that we could find it, but it's interesting that he had planned to go back, and maybe that would have prevented the terrorist attack. Maybe he wouldn't have come back at all, you know, and it's just interesting that it's such a damaging part, and we know a lot of killers that actually have a service background. So I think it does affect them to a certain point, and it's not an excuse, but I think it just piles onto everything else that they're thinking about why he bombed that building. It's coming up, I promise you.
Well, the journalist does turn to the political motives behind the bombing, and we see him become quite agitated and animated.
He returned to upstate New York and wrote a letter to his local newspaper saying in part that democracy was on the verge of failure and that, quote, America is in serious decline. You ended that letter with the words, do we have to shed blood to reform the current system? I hope it doesn't come to that, but it might.
Right.
Sounds like you were pretty angry when you came back.
I believe I had anger welling in me, yes.
McVeigh says that anger at the government intensified in 1992 over the conduct of federal law enforcement authorities during a standoff with white supremacist Randy Weaver at his home in Ruby Ridge, Idaho. FBI sharpshooters killed Weaver's wife and young son. One of the agents involved in the shooting was charged with manslaughter, but the FBI insisted it was an accident, and a federal judge dismissed the charges. Tell me what it is about that shootout at Ruby Ridge that concerned you.
I could say the use of what is no more or less snipers in a domestic non-wartime situation, federal agents taking on the role of judge, jury, and executioner. And then to further add insult to injury, you have these people, these federal agents, not held accountable. They become immune from the law.
Okay, so killing in war and the terrorist bombing of the Murray Building, he considers should be immune from the law, but law officials killing people during a standoff should be charged. Surely he can't have it both ways.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he sort of goes against his own arguments so many times, you know, and we will do the Ruby Ridge siege, I promise you that, because it's a very good, interesting case. Okay. You know, but the tragic events of that, that saw Weaver's son and wife being killed, it's not a reason to then go and destroy an entire building. You know, and that article that we saw first up, that he says, you know, it may come to violence to actually get things to happen. That shows that he was already thinking about things like this, and he's there to fight for the smaller person that that's being persecuted by government agencies, FBI, and all of that. But he's just seeing it in a black and white way that it just doesn't make sense.
Well, it's interesting because he seems to have kept a close eye on how law enforcement weighs into these kind of situations, because he now goes into the Waco siege, which was a few months after Ruby Ridge. And, in fact, he went to Waco to watch the weeks-long standoff.
Shaken, disillusioned, angered that could happen in this country where our core beliefs are freedom and liberty. And what did you do to these people? You deprived them of life, liberty, and property. You didn't guarantee those rights. You deprived them of them.
What also disturbs McVeigh about Waco was the government's use of tear gas against the men, women, and children inside the Branch Davidian compound.
The thing that hits me the hardest about that is the CS gas. Just knowing what it does, and knowing as some adults can barely breathe because of it. When I saw it introduced into a building full of kids like that, it just, the emotions it brings up make me speechless.
There are a lot of people who are upset by that, who would say, yeah, what happened there is wrong, but those are isolated incidents. That was just Ruby Ridge and Waco. What would you say to them?
I would say I don't necessarily believe that to be true. I think for people that follow the news and follow events, there are patterns of abuse evident.
The mind of this guy. He's upset that tear gas or whatever gas it was used on kids, but he has killed kids, lest we forget. But he's really mad over all this, isn't he?
Yeah, you know, he doesn't believe that the journalist sees the bigger picture. He's saying, you know, these might be isolated incidents, but it's happening everywhere and no one is seeing it, you know, and so it takes these bigger cases to actually make people stand up and think, shit, what's going on? You know, why did ATF do what they did at Waco? And we're definitely doing Waco. It's just that he says, you know, that these people had their safety and security and lives taken away from them by the government. Didn't he do the same thing to government officials and their babies?
Like, and you know, their children. 100%.
Yeah. You know, like, why is that bad and his good? But, you know, and he's angry. He keeps, you know, screwing up his eyebrows. He's like, you know, don't you get it? Don't you get what I'm saying? Don't you see the bigger picture? I am that the government is going to keep doing this. We're going to have Wacos every week until this gets solved. You know, the fact that he doesn't see September 11 because he's executed before that, I would have loved to see what his take was on that. That would have been fascinating.
Yeah, well, the journalist does put it to McVeigh, how should citizens react if they don't agree with what the government is doing?
There are many options.
Is violence an acceptable option?
If government is the teacher, violence would be an acceptable option.
What do you mean?
Well, what did we do to Sudan? What did we do to Afghanistan? Belgrade? What are we doing with the death penalty? It appears they use violence as an option all the time.
So if the government uses this, it's okay for us as citizens to use it?
I'll let my explanation stand for itself.
I think we can pretty much safely say the answer is yes. He thinks that violence is a good answer. It is amazing how he's worried about the tear gas on the children at Waco, but the burns, the crush injuries, and the violence he did was okay. He really does want to have it both ways, doesn't he?
He does. And, you know, the fact that he threw the death penalty in there too, that's unconstitutional. He sentenced all those people to death. Had he killed 1,000 people, he sentenced 1,000 people to death. He can't have it. Yes, there is wars going on. Yes, a lot of these wars shouldn't be happening, but they are, you know, and that's not what we're discussing today, and we're not discussing gun violence and all of that sort of stuff. This is about him taking into his own hands an act of terrorism to terrify his own government into acting differently. You know, it's not going to happen. We saw September 11 really didn't change anything, that we can't take water bottles onto planes. You know, it's, things are still happening. But he thinks that that act was going to overhaul the entire government. That's all he had to do. He's going to sit back and, you know, just do what he needed to do. Then, you know, he had his earplugs in, so he didn't burst his eardrums with those explosions. I mean, this is how egocentric he was.
And it's all self-serving, especially when he's bringing up the death penalty, knowing that that could be his fate, basically, yeah, after this. The interview now turns to McVeigh's arrest and why he thinks his trial was unfair, and he begins with that first perp walk he did after being charged.
McVeigh believes these images of him, taken 2 days after his arrest in 1995, in leg irons and handcuffs, surrounded by federal agents, and broadcast repeatedly around the country, tainted the perceptions of the jurors at his trial. And that is a primary basis for his appeal.
When I was marched out of the Perry County Courthouse in the orange jumpsuit, that was the beginning of a propaganda campaign. There would not be any denying that they do engage in propaganda campaigns to demonize defendants. And
so you think when you were marched out that that was intentional to demonize you?
I believe it was. And as, let's say, as a layman sitting back watching TV, you see a defendant in an orange jumpsuit and you think, well, that's the person they've caught. That person must be guilty. It's just, it's natural.
I just need a moment. I just need to really stop and think about poor Timothy McVeigh and what he must have gone through being paraded in public after killing all those people. You can't help but feel sad for him, can you, Amanda? Like, it's almost enough to bring a tear to a glass eye. What a fucking idiot.
Absolutely. You know, he's saying that the perp walk was unfair. But really, you know, yes, it is a use of defence that often happens. And, you know, people say that, you know, I'm innocent until proven guilty. And so wearing the orange jumpsuit suggests I'm already a prisoner and all of this, you know. And like, they even had his trial moved to Colorado away from Oklahoma so that there wasn't such a tainted jury pool. Of course, the whole world knew that this happened. So it was going to be hard to find someone living under a rock who didn't know about this attack, you know. But he's forgetting that the perp walk wasn't the evidence that they used to convict him. It was the 9 months of planning, going to these places, hiring the rental truck, you know, walking away on camera, being caught, and, you know, all of this sort of stuff and all of this planning. Yeah, that's not an issue for him. It's that he got perp walked.
Because it seems to me that he focuses in on little things like, he has a sense of justice in his head, right? So, he's guilty when you use all the other evidence. But that perp walk in his mind was unfair. He hadn't been found guilty of anything, and yet he's being paraded in front of the media so they can all get their shot and show him in a guilty-looking stance. And you know what? In a moment of seriousness, there is some validity to that, mm-hmm, right? But they also knew they had their man.
Yeah. I mean, in Australia, if we do a perp walk, they actually blur their faces, because until they're found guilty, we don't show their faces. And this is what is different. We have so much access to criminal cases in the US. It's amazing. But it also comes at a cost of things like this, because there are people that have been perp walked that have been innocent. The Atlanta Olympic Games case is a perfect example, that the guy that actually saved people's lives, they thought was the actual bomber, and will do him as well. And he was perp walked, and he was like, it destroyed his life. And the fact that he wasn't even the person who did it, it just shows that it can go against some people. But that guy was the guy who did it was Eric Rudolph, I think. He wasn't perp walked as much as the original guy whose name escapes me right now. But it just shows that there is an issue there, but that's not why he got convicted.
No. And look, there is a bigger issue here. Even in Australia, the neighbour of William Tyrrell, the little boy who went missing in the Spider-Man outfit, his life, he says, has been destroyed because he was a person of interest and has since been found to have had nothing to do with it. He has won a settlement from the government, which is now being challenged, even though his whole life, his business has been destroyed. So there are much bigger issues in that. But in the whole of things, when there's this mountain of evidence against you, in this case, you're barking up the wrong tree. But interestingly, the interview actually does put this question to seven of McVeigh's jurors and asks if the perp walk affected their decision in any way. Six of them had seen it. Four of them say they knew the killer was now in custody, so McVeigh was asked what he thought of the jury.
I believe that they came in with preconceived notions and that in the back of their minds, their minds were made up.
I mean, you realize that most people in this country think you're responsible for the bombing, correct?
Correct.
Right? So if your perception is that you didn't get a fair trial, they're saying, so what?
It's because I believe in the principle of the matter. There is a presumption of innocence followed by an open and honest jury that's fair and impartial.
So you tell me if I'm right or wrong. Your concern is not guilt or innocence, but the right to a fair trial.
It's the integrity of the process.
He actually has good arguments, almost as good as Manson's. I want to take a moment and say, Amanda, I'm going to come back to that in a moment, but I just want to give a shout out to the people that shot this interview, the camera crew at 60 Minutes, because I am fascinated by the reflection of Manson in the glass behind the journalist. The framing is just exquisite. And while they probably didn't have a lot of choices where they got to shoot it and how it worked, just they could have easily put McVeigh in that seat, but they framed it in such a way that the lighting on McVeigh, you see McVeigh over the shoulder in the glass reflected behind the 60 Minutes journalist. I just think it's so well done. Even if you don't subscribe to us on Patreon or Uscreen, go and have a look at it on YouTube, the 60 Minutes interview. But I said it, this guy's arguments are as good as Manson. He believes the system should have been fair and impartial to him, even though the reason behind him carrying out the bombing was because he believed the system is broken, biased, and unfair.
Yeah, this is what I'm thinking, mate. You are stupider than a bag full of hammers. You just it's just, it gets to a point you think, really, mate? Like you're wanting to have everything fair, and you want the government system to work.
And so that's why you bomb people. Ideals. And despite all the evidence, I sort of think that if, I don't know, this is off the top of my head, but do you think that if he felt he had had a fair trial, that he would be okay with his guilty verdict? Or is it, even though there's these mountains of evidence, he's hyper-focused on these elements where he goes, that wasn't fair. And so that sits with him badly.
No, what it is that the case was so watertight and done so well that they're trying to get rat shit out of Pepper. They're really trying to find something that's not there. And that's what is going on here.
That's two expressions in 2 minutes I've never heard before.
Oh, okay.
As dumb as a bag full of hammers and get rat shit out of Pepper.
Sorry.
Amanda-isms. All right. The journalist then asks why McVeigh sat through weeks of witness and victim testimony with little interest or sympathy.
I was raised in an environment where men don't cry. You hold it back. Obviously, there's a different cultural phenomenon in America now with President Clinton and his whole tear act all the time. But for me, through coming into adulthood, it's one of the things that a guy learns is how to hold back tears and not let it be shown.
Oh, he does not like Clinton. He says it's a tough guy act and he suppresses his emotions. That little contempt verbally and the snarl at the end of that when he mentioned Clinton shows that he certainly does have emotions, but he does keep them in check.
Yeah, poor big tough guy who's not allowed to cry, but other people can. You know, it's just he's so unemotional. But his attacks were because of his emotions on the government, that he hated them and he didn't like what they were doing and he didn't like what they were saying. So he is an emotional brat who decided to kill people because he was too small to be noticed. And like, he could have just run for parliament, you know. But anyway, he just thinks that he had to be tough and everything. I bet he cried like a baby after they charged him, 100%.
Well, interesting. Look, an interesting side note to this is that McVeigh shared a prison wing with Ted Kaczynski, and at one point the journalist, well, of course, as you would, asks about that.
Did you ever talk to Kaczynski?
I did.
Do you think that you and he share similar concerns about how the government operates these days?
We have somewhat different views, but there is some common ground there. I found that in a way that I didn't realize, that we were much alike in that all we ever wanted, or all we wanted out of life, was the freedom to live our own lives, however we chose to. And he expressed that one day, and it hit me that, well, you know, this labeling, he's far left, I'm far right, that's all out the window. There's a lot more commonality there.
You both think you had lost the freedom to live your life the way you wanted to, and you think that the government took those freedoms from you.
From my perspective, I believe that it's a problem with government. From Ted's perspective, he believes it's a problem with technology.
Well, look, it's interesting. We know that Kaczynski is very intelligent. Can't say the same about McVeigh. It is interesting that they had common goals and ideals. Do you think Kaczynski would have dismissed McVeigh as a poorly organized individual with little insight?
I think you've hit it in one there. I don't think that those conversations were going to be a battle of wits. I can't see Kaczynski spending much time talking to the spoiled army brat who just wanted to have a tantrum and take people with him.
Although I guess if you're in prison bored, you'll talk to anyone.
I don't know.
Well, McVeigh is then asked for his one-word opinions of various government departments that were involved in the incidences that he used as his motive.
Let me ask you your opinion, just a snapshot opinion of some of the institutions in this country and some officials in this country. ATF, for example, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau.
Should not have law enforcement jurisdiction, should be taxation agency.
The IRS?
I believe they're an out-of-control agency.
FBI?
Should be reined in.
What do you think of the Attorney General, Jan Arena?
They say if you don't have anything good to say about somebody, you don't say it. So we'll go on to the next person.
President Clinton.
I don't hold him in high regard.
Didn't really have much to say, did he?
No, and it's interesting because I thought when they said Janet Reno, who took the blame for Waco once it went to investigation and everything, I was surprised that he didn't have a lot more to say about her. But obviously he didn't want to sort of go on the attack when it may come to her to actually pardon his death sentence. So, you know, there's all of that weighs into what he's going to say. But, you know, you would think that these are the government agencies that were to that he blamed for what he did. But, you know, he didn't really say, you know, they should be reined in, that they should be, you know, a tax agent. Like, you know, I know that they asked for one word and he gave a half sentence, but you would think that he would have more to say about these agencies. He spent 9 months fueled on anger for them to create this explosion and terrorist attack. So you'd think that he would have gone a bit further with that without, you know, saying, you know, that they all suck and should be killed, you know, but there's somewhere in there that he could have said something more than what he has about these agencies, which he essentially blames for everything that happened at Waco and Ruby Ridge.
Mm. Absolutely. Well, as we know, McVeigh was sentenced to death, and he was asked about how he felt about that.
Are you prepared for death?
I am. I came to terms with my mortality in the Gulf War. After that, it's not that hard to be, quote, prepared for death.
But there's a little different experience being in a war and having yourself exposed to danger as opposed to being in prison on death row, knowing that at some date down the line, there will be a lethal injection that will take your life.
In truth, from my psychological perspective, it's a little easier being on death row because you know how you're going to die. You can narrow down where you're going to die, and you can pretty much narrow down the time.
I know you have a lot of time to sit here and think.
Yes.
If you had your life to live over, is there anything you'd do differently?
I've thought about that quite a few times, and I think anybody in life says, I wish I could have gone back and done this differently, done that differently. There are moments, but no one that stands out.
Do you reckon, knowing what he knew at that point, if he could go back, would he have made the decision not to bomb the building? Or would he have made the decision to have a better plan to get away with it?
Yeah, I think he should have screwed the number plate on the back of the car on a bit tighter next time because that's how he got caught. I mean, they do silly things like that, and it's just so interesting that they planned this thing. You know, they knew where they were going to get the truck from. They knew where they were going to put it. They knew where the getaway car was going to be. He had the earplugs and everything, but the back number plate was loose. Like, guys, come on, you're so freaking dumb.
What happened to the getaway driver?
Oh, he's in jail for the rest of his life too. So, but he doesn't speak and doesn't say anything purely because of what was going on with McVeigh. He didn't want the same sentence, but he got life.
Okay. Because McVeigh was sentenced to death and after all of his avenues of appeals were exhausted, he was executed on 11 June 2001. What were his final words, Amanda?
Well, he actually read the poem Invictus and the end of it says, beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how chained with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate and I am the captain of my soul. So it was all about him.
Yeah, of course. And he never expressed any remorse?
No, that's all he said when he was on the slab.
All right, well, thank you. It's another fascinating case, Amanda, and I look forward to seeing you next week where we've got a very interesting one. We're going back into the world of cults.
Oh, yes, one of my favourite topics, so I can't wait.
We'll see you next week for Monsters Who Murder Serial Killer Confessions. See ya.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.